person at Sicky of 1986 would have hated. That's okay, because I don't think I'd like to know Sicky in 2006 either, so we're even. I was listening to Velvet Underground again today, and Heroin sounds as good as ever, especially when Lou Reed sings about heroin being his death, his life, and his wife. Who would have thought when I was growing up in Idaho that one of the most inspirational songs of my life would also end up being my theme song? Now, I could burn these insane diaries or put them back where I found them. Nobody would ever be the wiser. So why have I decided to publish them and show the world just what a fucked up, strung out madman I was at the height of my success? Well, it's simple. If one person listens to this audiobook and doesn't have to go down the same road as me, it was worth sharing my personal hell with them. I'm also donating profits from this book to help runaway kids at a charity I set up called Running Wild in the Night through Covenant House. You can check it out online at covenanthouse.org. They say to keep what you have, you have to give it away. I believe that. I also believe that you can be cool as fuck, not give a fuck, and fucking kick ass in life and not be fucked up. I'm still the first person to say fuck you, but I'm faster to say I love you. If life is what you make it, I've made mine great. It took a lot of hard work. And if you need to, you can do it too. Last but not least, the lines I wrote in Home Sweet Home in 1985 are as true today as they were back then. My heart's like an open book for the whole world to read. Welcome to my nightmare. Enjoy. Nikki Sixx, December 2006.
Introduction 2. I first met Nikki Sixx on Valentine's Day 1986. Motley Crue flew into London on the Theatre of Pain tour. I was writing for now-defunct British music magazine Melody Maker, and we exchanged a few sweet nothings in an interview. Nikki wasn't making too much sense. I went away thinking, that guy is wasted. By the end of the night, he'd OD'd and been dumped into rubbish bin, and that was when he really started going downhill. Nearly 20 years later, Nikki asked me to work with him on The Heroin Diaries, and I got greater insight into the abject mess that he called his life back then. When Nikki first started showing me his remaining journal scribblings and scraps of paper from back then, I was horrified, and I could not believe he was still alive. Some pages of Nikki's diary were intact, many were not, but by scouring his memory and researching old notes and documents, we were able to fill in the black holes and piece together the story of a man who, at the beating heart of an over-the-top rock band, was profoundly falling apart at the seams. Nikki asked me to get the other sides of the horror story, so I sought out the people whose lives he was terrorizing back then, the Motley band members who tolerated and or feared him, the lovers who were sucked into his daily insanity, the estranged mother who longed to be close to him. Unsurprisingly, they had some pretty shitty things to say about the out-of-control junkie they knew back then. But Nikki wanted all the insults and the atrocities itemized in this book. I can think of no other rock star of his stature who would be so honest or so courageous. The Heroin Diaries is not easy reading. It is a book that you will never forget. Ian Gittins, December 2006.
December 1986. Merry Christmas. Well, that's what people say at Christmas, right? December 25th, 1986, Van Nuys, 7:30 p.m. Merry Christmas. Well, that's what people say at Christmas, right? Except normally they have somebody to say it to. They have their friends and family all around them. They have them in crouched naked under a Christmas tree with a needle in their arm, like an insane person in a mansion in Van Nuys. They're not out of their minds and writing in a diary, and they're not watching their holiday spirit coagulating in a spoon. I didn't speak to a single person today. I thought of calling Bob Timmons, but why should I ruin his Christmas? I guess I've decided to start another diary, this time for a few different reasons. One, I have no friends left. Two, so I can read back and remember what I did the day before. And three, so if I die, at least I have a paper trail of my life. Nice little suicide note. Merry Christmas. It's just you and me, Diary. Welcome to my life.
Bob Timmons. By Christmas 1986, Nikki had been addicted to heroin and cocaine for at least a year, possibly longer. As a drug counselor, I first met Nikki when Motley Crue's manager, Doc McGee, called me in to work with the band's singer, Vince Neil. Nikki was initially very hostile to me. He tried to get me barred from going backstage or being around them. Nikki and I slowly formed a relationship, and early in 1986, he asked me for help with his own addictions. I advised him to get into a rehab center, but he refused and said he didn't need to. He was very stubborn on that issue. Over the years, I have worked with platinum-selling artists from the Rolling Stones to the Red Hot Chili Peppers and all points in between, and let me make one thing clear from the start. Motley Crue, more than anybody, wrote the book for decadence and partying. In that area, they were the most extreme people I ever met, and Nikki was the most extreme of all. For many years, Nikki had one motto. I'm going to do exactly what I want to do, and fuck everybody else.
December 26, 1986. Van Nuys, 2:10 a.m. Jason came over again today. I was touched, so there is a Santa Claus, after all. He came mooching in with his greasy James Dean hair and his junky eyes that are sunk in so deep in his elongated face that he looks like he's wearing makeup. And he stood by the tree and asked me how my Christmas had been. Like he cares. Like he doesn't know already that it was exactly the same as his. Sometimes Jason pisses me off when he tries to make small talk. He asked me how much gear I wanted. I asked him, how much have you got? And he gave me this contemptuous, sneering look and said, that must be nice. His Betty Page wannabe goth girlfriend Anastasia, she isn't much better. But she's nice enough, but I know on the inside I'm just her meal ticket to an easier, softer life. I know she tells Jason to jump when I call because she, more than he, wants the money. Not just for junk. They make enough off me to maintain their cheap little habits, but she likes to decorate their little one-room rat's nest with extra money they have left over. That's the real reason that she demands he come at my beck and call. She likes that extra cash for thrift shops and secondhand stores. I see her as a sort of Susie homemaker from hell, but it's all just a fantasy. She's stuck with the habit, too. My dealer Jason and I had a real love-hate relationship. I loved him because I could pick up the phone and he'd be over in 20 minutes with everything that I needed. I hated him because it was killing me. He loved me because I gave him hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars on a daily basis. He hated me because I was a spoiled millionaire rock star who could have anything I wanted whenever I wanted it, and usually did. I used to ride a Honda Shadow motorcycle around the valley with my shirt off, totally out of my mind. One time Jason started talking about Harleys and how much he loved them. Tommy had one. So the next day, I just went out, bought one, and rode to Jason's house to score. He was furious. It was his dream bike. He'd shown me a picture of it, and I bought it. He thought I was such a spoiled brat. Jason was as fucked on heroin as me. He was a tall, skinny guy who in another life could have been a model or something, but he really just came off looking like a corpse. And that was the real reason he hated me. We were both living for drugs, but I could afford as many as I wanted. December 27, 1986, Van Nuys, 4:25 a.m. The best part of Freebase is before the first hit. I love that moment, right before I put the glass pipe to my lips. That moment when everything is sane, the craving, the salivating, the excitement, all feel fresh and innocent. It's like foreplay, the ache that's always better than the orgasm. Yet as soon as I hit the pipe, within 30 seconds, all hell breaks loose in my brain. And I keep on doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it, and I can't stop. Every day that I sit here and I write, it's always the same. So why? Why do I do this? I hate it. I hate it so much, but I love it even more. The worst part of Freebase is running out. but I have a new Jones, speedballs of any kind. The junk just isn't enough anymore. I feel like I'm only halfway there.
Tommy Lee. Back around Girls, 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 we were starting to make shitloads of money. With money came success, power, overindulgence, and experimentation. Six and I, in particular, took a lot of narcotics, and he would always want to push things. Hey, how about taking these two drugs together? How about heroin and cocaine at the same time? That period led us to this really dark fucking place. We all went to that place at various times, but Nikki seemed to like it there more than any of us.
December 28, 1986, Van Nuys, 9:40 a.m. After our binge last night, or was it tonight, I was convinced yet again that there were people coming to get me. It was more than just shadow and voices, more than just fantasies. It was real. I was scared to my core. My bones were shaking. My heart was pounding. I thought I was going to explode. I'm glad I have you to talk to write this down. I tried to keep it all together, but then I gave into the madness and became one with my insanity. I always end up in the closet in my bedroom. Let me tell you about that place, my closet. It's more than a closet. It's a haven for me. It's where I keep my dope and where I keep my gun. I know when I'm in there I'm safe, or at least until I get too high. I can't be out in the house. There are too many windows, and I know I'm being watched. Right now it seems impossible that cops are peering in from the trees outside or people are looking at me through the peephole in the front door. But when the drugs kick in, I can't control my mind. Today, last night, feels like a lifetime ago. But the sick thing is, I could do it all again tonight. This was the crazy routine I had at the time. I would start out freebasing or mainlining anywhere in the house, the front room, the kitchen, the bathroom. But as soon as the coke-induced psychosis kicked in, as soon as the insanity began, I would make a beeline for my bedroom closet. That was my refuge. I would huddle in there, surrounded by my drug paraphernalia and my guns, convinced people were in the house trying to get me, or a SWAT team was outside preparing to bust me. I'd be too scared to move until I came down. The only way to bring myself down quicker was heroin. Heroin would make the madness go away. It was the easy solution. It seemed to make sense at the time. December 29, 1986. Van Nuys, 4:30 p.m. I've been thinking about last Christmas Eve when I picked up that girl in a strip club, brought her back here on my bike, took her home the next day. Then I had Christmas dinner all by myself in McDonald's. I haven't made much progress, I see. Today I'm listening to Exile on Main Street, reading, lying around, tanning in the backyard, naked. Today I feel like my old self, but sometimes I feel like I have two personalities. One is Nikki, and one is sicky.
Ross Halfen. As a photographer, I've shot Motley Crue many times over the years for magazines and got particularly close to Nicky. I remember the first time I ever met him in L.A., we got on pretty well and decided to go for a drink that night. We sat talking in a booth. Vince Neil was in another booth with a girl arguing, and Vince suddenly stood up and punched her in the face. I asked Nicky, "Should we sort it out?" And Nicky just laughed and said, "Let them sort it out themselves."
January 1987. One could say that I've been having a 10cc love affair. January 1st, 1987. Van Nuys, 6 a.m. Vanity showed up yesterday with a mountain of coke. Kind of altered the day. I've been doing good until that point. I got a good night's sleep for the first time in days. I even managed to take a shower and pick up my guitar. But since this is a new diary, let me tell you about Vanity. She used to be a backup singer with Prince, or so she says. We met for all the wrong reasons and have only one real thing in common. Drugs. I mean, she's a sweet girl as much as I'm a sweet guy. She has flowing brown hair and chocolate brown eyes. and has the ability to look very pretty, but usually, like me, looks like hell. As they say, misfits attract misfits. Truer words could not be said. Motley's back in the studio next week, and I told the guys I have some new songs. The truth is, I haven't written much of anything. I just can't seem to focus on anything these days except the usual. So we did a few lines while Vanity cooked up the bass. She was talking about us going out tonight for New Year's Eve. But both of us know that we were going nowhere. The more she talked, the more all I could hear was my head talking, the craving, the wet palate for a hit on that glass pipe. It was beautiful and it was ugly all at the same time. Then everything went wrong, just like it always does. The bass fucked up Vanity's head and she started speaking in riddles, ranting on about Jesus and spirituality, like she was still with fucking Prince or something. She was making no sense and I couldn't take it, so I started yelling at her to go fuck herself and fuck Jesus and get the fuck out of my house. Then she was gone and I was back in my closet with my grandfather's gun pointed at the door. Needles and dirty spoons on the floor, terrified because people had slid into the front door like vapor and were in the house and were coming to get me. I fucking hate that shit. It's okay now, but nobody would believe what happens inside my head. It's haunted. Now that I've come down, it seems like a sick play I saw in a theater. 30 minutes ago, I could have killed somebody, or better yet, myself. But now I'm okay. I need a padded cell, I'm telling you. Oh yeah, Happy New Year. 11:30 a.m. Here comes the new year. Same as the old year. Pete said I really must open these Christmas presents soon. Vanity came and went during different periods of my addiction. She was a wild chick who had sung with Prince. She had also been his lover for a while. At the time, I thought Vanity as a disposable human being, like a used needle. Once its purpose was fulfilled, it was ready for the trash, only to be dug up if you were really desperate. Maybe the manner in which I met Vanity should have told me this was to be no normal relationship. Back in 1986, I used to hang out with a guy named Pete. In fact, he was semi-living in my house. Pete was a 6'6" cross between Keith Richards and Herman Munster and looked like the coolest rock star around, except he couldn't play. He used to sit in my house watching TV and snorting coke and pointing out girls that we would like to fuck. Then I would phone the Motley office and they'd get us the girls' numbers so we could call them. It was a sick little game we played, never really realizing that we were playing with people's lives. We saw Vanity on TV, and when Pete said, "Dude, that's Prince's old girl," I said, "Excellent! He's got a tiny dick!" The office rang Vanity and arranged for us to meet. She opened the door naked, with her eyes rolling around in her head. Somehow, I had the feeling that we might just hit it off. We became drug buddies. Sometimes, you could even just about call us boyfriend and girlfriend. Vanity also taught me how to really freebase. The first time I based was with Tommy when Motley just started out and only a few other times after that. So up until then, I'd mostly been snorting or injecting. But as soon as she showed me the real ins and outs of cooking up a good rock, it was love. Not her, the trug.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. Webster's Dictionary assassinates the word vanity, describing its meaning as worthless. What a bold mistake that was. God forgave me for that ugly name. You might say I was a collector. I collected a long list of vile addictions throughout my journey of paranoia, boldly going where most have not gone before, hiding behind the face that launched a thousand nothings. Most don't call me Vanity any longer. My friends call me Denise. The saints call me Evangelist. It doesn't really matter. I don't answer to Vanity. I would much rather be a fish stuck in a pond with a starving shark than take on such a foul name of nothingness. I am this new creature in Christ, and I persevere to keep changing for the better.
January 3rd, 1987. Van Nuys, 5:10 a.m. Dear Diary, here is a typical holiday day in my rock star paradise. Wake up around noon if I've been to bed. See if I'm alone. If I'm with somebody else, I try to remember what her name is, but that hasn't been happening too much lately. Girls have kind of stopped coming around. Crowd of bed, feel hungover or dope sick. Wipe last night out of my eyes. Wonder if I need a shower. Decide that I don't. I'll only get dirty again. On a good day, I pick up my guitar. On a bad day, I flop in front of MTV. Most days, I do both. Do a little bump to wake up. Some people use coffee for that. We all have our little rituals. Then it starts. The itch starts. The Coke makes me edgy. So I have a little sniff of my breakfast blend and a Valium or two to calm me down. But I need Jason. His answering machine is on. I sit here twitching until he phones back. When the phone rings, if it's Jason, it's the best thing in the world. If it's not, I want the person at the other end to die. Sometimes I wonder if they know I'm strung out and they are just calling to torment me. When Jason doesn't call at all, that's when the fucking Joneses start. Being dope sick is the worst feeling in the world. I hope it never happens to you, unless you have it coming. I could name a few. But when you're junk sick, you'll do just about anything for a fix. It's all you think about. It haunts you. Eventually, I go to my cottons, squeeze some lemon juice on them, and try to wring out a few cc's. I've done it all. Once I even shot up some weird stuff I found stuck in the bushes outside a drug dealer's house. Then I found out it wasn't some lucky find on my part. It was fucking crystallized brown sugar. Man, I thought I had hit the mother load when I found that baggie. When Jason finally shows up, he makes everything better. It's like he's got the power to heal, and that prick shows his power every chance he gets.
Vince Neil, you know the problem with Nikki Sixx? He can't do anything just a little bit. He can't do a little bit of coke. He's got to do all the coke. He can't take a little bit of heroin. He's got to take all the heroin. He can't just have one sip of wine. He's got to drink the bar out. There's no middle speed for that dude. It's 0 or 10.
January 4th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. Bob Michaels came over tonight. We drank a few beers and had a couple lines. Bob's a good guy, gets fucked up with me, but he's not like me. He's normal.
Bob Michaels. Nikki Sixx and I had been friends ever since the day in 1983 that he moved in next door to me. I remember seeing this real tall guy in 6-inch heels with lots of black hair and makeup and thinking, who the fuck is that? But we became friends real quick. That building was party central. I think everyone who lived there was involved in either supplying or consuming narcotics. Robin Crosby from Rat lived downstairs from Nikki, and Tommy was around all the time. I stayed friends with Nikki when he moved into his next house, on Valley Vista Boulevard in Van Nuys, but by then he was struggling with all kinds of addiction. Heroin, alcoholism. Nikki would put anything into his arm that he could. Heroin, coke, loads of other things that should never be put into an arm. Personally, I pinpoint his problems from Vince Neil going to jail in 1985. That make Nikki think for the first time, what would happen if the band stopped? Maybe it scared him because that's when his drug habit started to get out of control.
January 5th, 1987, Van Nuys, 9:30 p.m. Listening to the Dolls and the Stooges, wow, amazing. Then I mix in some John Lee Hooker or Buddy Miles. Then the first Aerosmith album. I love music. This is life, like Burroughs or Kerouac or Ginsberg, the flames who burn bright. Other people hide away from life. People like me or Keith Richards or Johnny Thunders, we live it. We're right here, feeling everything in the moment. The only way to be truly alive is to confront your mortality. I really used to think this way. Keith and Johnny lived like this, so why shouldn't I? I know it looks crazy now, but at the time it seemed the only way to live. I was just another wasted, confused, unraveling millionaire rock star.
Mick Mars. Nicky was always trying to rebel. He had enough money to act like Sid Vicious, and he always loved him, so that's exactly what he did. He role-played the part of Sid. Of course, it never seemed to occur to him that Sid ended up killing himself. Did Nicky take so many drugs back then because he wasn't happy? Well, I'm pretty unhappy now, and I'm not taking them.
January 6th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 p.m. There's this funny thing about heroin. The first time you do it, you throw up. You feel sick, you can't move. You lay on your back, and your head spins, and your body flops. You say to yourself, this is the stupidest drug ever. Only the dumb of the dumb would ever do it again. So why did I do it again? Because my heroes did. Because I idolized my heroes. Because they didn't care. And I really don't care about anything. Heroin, once it became my friend, became like a warm blanket on a cold night. Now I can't imagine living without it. I can't imagine not having it. I don't get sick from it now. I get sick if I don't do it. Isn't it funny how that works? Cocaine made me high until I went too far and became wild and psychotic. Heroin balanced that out and made me calm. I would self-medicate in my house for days with the obsessive addiction of a research scientist. Maybe I saw it as a yin and yang thing. It all made sense in my junkie wonderland.
Tommy Lee. The first time I took heroin was at Nicky's place at Valley Vista Boulevard. He was taking it and I thought, fuck, I want to try this shit. I shot up on his couch, pulled the needle out, and immediately had the biggest rush on the planet. I was just lying there. Then within a minute, I had to rush to his bathroom, spraying throw up through my fingers. Then I came out really high, walked back to his couch, and just passed out. Later, I thought, I'm not sure that I like this. The needle hurt on the way in. There was a very short, really high point. Then I threw up and passed out. What the fuck is this? I asked Nicky, are you sure about this shit? But unlike me, Six seemed to be pretty fucking sure.
January 8th, 1987, Van Nuys, 3:25 a.m. Sometimes, if I didn't know better, I think my dealer's trying to kill me. Little mean faces, here I sit in the dark, letting my insanity run away. Little mean faces stare back at me, chanting rhythms of my fate. I know they're not real, and I'm sure I'm really quite sane, because if I was crazy, I would have given them all little names. 10 a.m. Pete won't admit it, but he's got a habit too. Noon. To-do list. Buy guitar strings. Buy food. Call management back. Return the decorator's call. Get more locks for the doors. And replace the busted back window. You know, my house was the site of constant misadventure. All sorts of mayhem would unfold. One day I'd get a stripper's pole and put it in my bedroom because I thought it would be classy. A few days later, I'd tear it down because I decided it was crass. There were constant, spontaneous decor rethings. It was very confusing, even for such a confused time. It tends to be that way when you're going insane. January 9th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. I love this house, the times that I don't hate it. It's funny how I never saw the place before I bought it. Nicole chose the place for me. Then we moved in. Made it our heroin den, and hardly left for months. Now Nicole's moved out, and I've got Vanity. I've gone from a junkie to a crackhead. Is that progress? But I love prowling around this house from room to room. I love that it's so dark, a house that can keep secrets. I don't ever want to leave here, but I have to, because rehearsals start next week. That house was on Valley Vista Boulevard in Van Nuys. My former girlfriend, Nicole, had chosen it for me. I was touring Theater of Pain with Motley Crue, and she would view properties in Los Angeles, video them, and bring the videos out on the road to show me. Took me about a minute to say yes. What was the big deal? I had so much money then, I could have bought anywhere. So I hired a decorator who would turn up for the meetings with all of her fabrics and samples and find me strung out of my head. She'd step over needles and empty Coke bindles and the comatose naked girls on my $25,000 Persian rugs with cigarette burns on them. And she'd never even bat an eye. I must hand it to her. She was a professional. My house was full of red velvet hangings, gothic furniture, antiques, and gargoyles loomed at you from the darkness. It was a house to lose yourself in and to lose your mind in. January 9th, 1987, Van Nuys, 9:40 p.m. Today I made myself pick up my guitar, knowing that I have to write more songs for this next album. I managed to string it, but the writing just wasn't happening, and that scares me because music is all that I live for. Tommy and Vince and even Mick have their families to go home to at the end of the day. Music has always been my family, and now I'm losing that too. Every corner of my mind is filled with spiderwebs and fear. January 11th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11 p.m. Me and Pete spent the day shooting the breeze. Pete talks like he has loads of things going on, but he never really gets shit together. He still owes me the $9,000 bail I posted for him after he got busted on probation with track marks on his arm. He says, "I'll get it back one day." Whatever. I realized something about Pete. His hair always looks so cool, with all weird pieces and extensions woven into it, but I've never seen him without a hat or without a towel over his head when he gets out of the shower. It's too perfect. Is it even his own hair? I think it's a fucking wig. You know, I never did get my money back from Pete. After he vanished, I heard many stories of his adventures from people over the years. The last one I heard was that he had been sent to jail after trying to rob a bank on a bicycle. I have no idea if it's true or not, but it would be a very Pete thing to do. January 12, 1987, Van Nuys, 4 p.m. I've enrolled in a methadone program, and I think it's going to go well. Davey just told me he kicked a bad Persian habit this way, so I'm hopeful. So every morning at 9, I'm down here, the rock star junkie in his blacked-out Corvette, lining up in my ski cap and sunglasses with all the others for my daily dose. I'm going to kick this shit. I know I am. This has to work. I don't know how I'm going to tour like this if it doesn't. I can do it as long as I don't chip too much. Most methadone programs last 30 days and are intended to wean addicts off of heroin while keeping them away from dirty needles, HIV, dealers, and the general paraphernalia of the drug world. I used to get my methadone dose, then call on Jason for dope. Did it work? I was so strung out that I think I may have simply added methadone to my already impressive list of existing addictions. Davey, whose real name can't be disclosed, is one of the biggest rock stars in the world. I can't tell you his name, but I sure loved his music growing up. January 3rd, 1987, Van Nuys, 9 p.m. Today I phoned my sister. I have no idea why. We have nothing to say to each other.
Cece Comer. My brother Nicky is 7 years older than me, and he is imprinted in my heart like my faith, which is strange but true, because he hasn't always deserved to be. Never understood it, but the feeling has never left me. But there have been plenty of times I've despised him, too. When we were kids, we would play together in El Paso. We made mudslides, he ripped his foot open, caught horny toads and snakes, and shot Roman candles at each other on July 4th inside a cement mixer. One time, Grandpa pulled a huge cactus thorn from his kneecap. Another time, Nicky sliced his finger on the pig pen so bad that it was hardly attached. It was just wobbling and shooting torrential downpours of blood. He even got struck by lightning in our doorway one day. Nicky became my hero when he saved me from a big rattlesnake. I thought I could pet it, but he ran and picked me up as it was about to strike. He used to keep snakes as pets. Once, one of them killed and ate my quarter turtle, and I wanted to kill that snake. Nikki still owes me for that. Then Mom and I moved to Washington, and Nikki went to live with our grandparents. I think in Mom's mind it was only ever temporary, and Nikki would come to join us when the dust had settled. But he never did come to stay with us. I think maybe Nikki figured Mom loved me more than him, but it wasn't that. I was just younger and in her possession. And Mom tried to always have a room for Nikki in whatever house we lived in. After Nikki got famous, we really drifted apart. He'd never contact us apart from occasionally when he was coming to town, and the times that I did hear from him, he was such an ass. He'd ask me how things were, and when I'd tell him, he would cut the conversation short or change the subject. He was rude, full of himself, and just crushed me so many times. He was an asshole.
January 14th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 a.m. Last night after Jason left was madness. I'm not having him bring smack very often, but my coke intake is up 1,000%. I was creeping around the house, listening to the voices, when I noticed all the platinum discs hanging on the walls, and suddenly I hated them. Why were they there? Motley is all about music and passion, not awards from a dumb industry that hates us and skims millions of dollars off of us. So I went from room to room, wrenching the discs off the walls and dumping them into the garage. Then I suddenly felt stupid. We earned those discs. We should be proud of them. So I put them all on the floor below where they used to hang. We're back in the studio tomorrow.
Bob Michaels. Nikki is a very driven individual. Sometimes he'd put drugs on the back burner for a while for cars or 17-foot trucks, but it got to the point where nothing else mattered but getting high. He went from being fun to never being happy unless he was totally wasted. He used to check his mailbox 7 times a day, but it wasn't the mail he was after. It was the drugs that the dealers used to leave there for him. He'd go to the mailbox, then to the bathroom, and come out a much more comfortable person.
Insanity runs deep in everyone but me. My padded walls you call my eyes, my dreams that you call my lies. Around my wrists my shackles lay, razor blades and cocaine to pass the time away. January 15th, 1987, Van Nuys, 8:30 p.m. Today we were back in the studio, writing for the new album. I rode in on my Harley feeling all jittery and decided to stop for a small fix. Went into Denny's on Gower and Sunset, always the classy guy. I didn't have a spoon, so I bought a bottle of Pepsi, threw the bottle away, kept the cap, went into the bathroom to shoot up. The shitter was disgusting, black rings and shit stains all around the bowl, and the unclever graffiti all over the walls. I sat on my motorcycle helmet on the floor and filled the cap with water from the toilet. I don't know why I didn't fill it from the sink like any sane person would. I put the bottle cap on the toilet seat in the piss and the stains and poured the coke in it. I drew it up in the syringe, washed it out in the shit water. Put my little China white in the cap and cooked it, burning my fingers. I had no cottons, so I just drew it up and shot up. The studio was fine after that. I just felt dead.
Doug Thaler. I co-managed Motley Crue together with Doc McGee for many years, and when I first started, Nikki was a pain in the ass. He just had a knee-jerk reaction against us as authority figures and never understood we were trying to help him. I used to go to band meetings with my stomach tied in knots. One day I just snapped and said to him, "You can't be an asshole all your life." I offered that in the future I'd present ideas and strategies to him before the rest of the band, and he liked that. After that, we got along a lot better. I'd like to think he saw me as a sort of elder brother or even a mentor. One side effect of Nikki's control freak nature was that whenever Motley was in the studio, he wanted to be there every single minute of the night and day. On Girls, 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 he was a lot more removed from the process. He often wasn't there at all, and when he did come in, he was in no shape to do anything. He would just be making no sense. That's when I started to realize how ill he was.
January 16th, 1987, Van Nuys, 10:10 p.m. Last night was a bad one. When I rode into the studio this afternoon, I knew I was still high, and the others seemed shocked at the state I was in. I started showing them a new song, but Tommy interrupted me and asked, "Dude, what's on your hand?" He'd seen my track marks, so I told him that I met a chick a few days ago and we pulled an all-nighter, done a little shooting up, coke. Tommy just looked at me as if to say, that was no party. He could see that my hands were one big scab. I'm looking at them now as I write. All my veins have collapsed. But Tommy never said anything. Nobody ever does. The guys aren't exactly angels themselves, so it would just be the pot calling the kettle black. Motley doesn't like confrontation, and they don't like to cross me. So I taught them the new song, and everything was okay.
Tommy Lee. Nikki was turning up to the studio for the Girls, Girls, Girls session in a bit of a fucking mess. I guess we were all in a bit of a mess, but Nikki definitely went that one step further than the rest of us. He'd show up really late, he and I would chase the dragon in the bathroom, then we'd go back into the studio to try to work. I think it's fair to say that our focus was on the drugs and not on the music. Vince Neil. I knew Nikki had a drug problem right back when we were doing Shout at the Devil. We all had drug problems at our own levels, but Nikki's just seemed more amplified than anybody else's. But he never got in trouble for it. If anything happened, it was taken care of right away. Our management always just smoothed everything over because Nikki was writing songs and making money for everybody. Why would they want to throw a stone in the wheel and stop the money machine from turning? Tim Lutzy. I was Nikki's bass technician for many years, including during the recording of the Girls, Girls, Girls album. I first started working for him when they made Too Fast for Love, and remember that on my first day, Nikki came into the studio with a black eye, having spent the night in a police cell. That pretty much set the tone for what was to follow.
January 17th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. Today, I went into the studio and everyone was staring at me and asking what happened to me yesterday. Apparently, I just vanished. I went to the bathroom and never came back. Between me and you, I guess I was in a bit of a blackout. So I started teaching them a new song. I gave Vince the lyrics and showed Mick the guitar riff. They said nothing and started playing. They were good. They got it right away. Then halfway through the song, I realized they already knew it. I'd shown them the song yesterday. I didn't say anything, of course. Neither did they. What could they say? It was a very uncomfortable feeling. I think we all realized right there that this isn't what it used to be. The drugs are running the show, and we're all just scared to death. I'm sure they called Doug and Doc after I left. I expect a call any day. They must know I'm going insane.
Mick Mars. When we were making Girls, 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 Nikki would ride down to the studio on his motorcycle, come in, look at the place, say, "Okay, we're done," and then everybody would go home. That was pretty much the way it was. I don't think he even knew what he was doing. It was pretty horrible. The only good thing, from my point of view, was that it made him much less of a control freak than usual. Doc McGee. As a manager, I used to be very close to Nikki, but while Motley was doing Girls, 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 he was just out there. We saw he had a problem, and I realized he was coming apart, unraveling, but it was a crazy period. We didn't talk as much as before because he was just never there. When you're a heroin addict, you just gravitate towards the few people that you do the drug with. Everybody else just stays away. I knew what the problem was, and I had hoped it was just something that Nikki was going through, but heroin isn't something you just go through. It's the worst drug in the world.
January 18th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:40 p.m. I don't know if this album we're making is good. I don't know if I even like it. And if I don't like it, who will? I have to pull it together. I don't know how to stop. I don't want to go to rehab again, but I'm at a loss for how to get off. It amazes me now that nobody from Motley Crue said anything to me about the state I was in. I was writing some pretty lame songs and nobody dared tell me they sucked. Were they scared to challenge me? Looking back, I don't blame them.
Ross Halfen. I don't think people were scared of Nicky. They just didn't care. He was their paycheck and they didn't give a shit if he was falling to bits as long as he got up there on stage. Back then there was an anything-goes sort of time. Doc was doing drugs. So was Doug. Everyone was. The only person as bad as Nicky was Tommy. And even he wasn't doing heroin. He was just snorting coke and drinking. Without Nicky, Doc couldn't have been making money, nor would Doug, Vince, the road crew, the record company, anybody. So they all ignored Nicky's condition and said he was fine. He was the emperor, and it was the emperor's new clothes.
January 19th, 1987, Van Nuys, 8:30 a.m. Some days I'm King Kong with a bass guitar. Today Mick wanted to modulate a guitar line, and I just yelled at him, "Fuck you, that's lame." Mick looked at me like I crapped in his amp, but he never said anything. He never does. He's too kind, unlike me. I make myself sick. I can be such a pompous asshole sometimes. I feel shitty when I do stuff like that, but I know I'm overcompensating because right now I'm the weak link in the studio. But I shouldn't take it out on the band.
Mick Mars. Nicky and I had a love-hate relationship ever since we met in a liquor store before we even formed Motley Crue. I went to buy some tequila and he asked me who I liked and I said, "Jeff Beck and Bebop Deluxe." And he said, "Fuck you. I like Aerosmith and Kiss." So we hated each other from the start. But when he started taking heroin, it really pissed me off. The first time I ever saw him take it was when we were rehearsing for the Theater of Pain tour, and I was that angry that I called our management and told them. I told Nicky way back then not to mess with heroin, but he never listened to me. He never did.
January 21st, 1987. Van Nuys, 11 a.m. Vanity called last night and asked me to come over and play. I had nothing else to do, so I figured, why not? As soon as she opened the door, I could see from her eyes she hadn't slept for days. She looked at me like a scared little cartoon character. She started showing me all her art as we freebase, then I noticed a huge bouquet of flowers in the corner of the room. There must have been 24 dozen roses. I asked her who they were from, and she wouldn't say, so I read the card. "Vanity, drop him, take me back, Prince." I'm so pissed. She may be fucking insane, but she's my girl. If I see that little dwarf, I'll kick his ass. Vanity's art was crazy shit. She'd get these huge boards and spray paint them white, then stick nuts and bolts all over them. There would be a little Santa Claus she called a gift from God, and there was always a devil in there somewhere. She'd be telling me to talk to Jesus, but I didn't feel like we had much to say to each other. As for the flowers, I found out from her sister that they weren't even from Prince. She had sent them to herself to fuck with my head. Let's give her credit. She always found plenty of ways to do that.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. I had more addictions than just cocaine. I've been sober now for 13 years, but the root of my problems went much deeper. There was the bitterness, envy, strife, hatred, emulations, judgmental thoughts, selfishness, and the enslavement of fornication. There was the money, the fame, the fortune, the drugs and paraphernalia, which naturally brought upon the demonic, the psychic, and all of the witchcraft, not to mention the foul, perverted tongue and the bondage of idolatries. My iniquity was as a catastrophic snowball rolling down a ski slope, collecting ugly. I definitely needed some saving.
Doc McGee. Nicky was into Vanity, but I think a lot of that was because she had come out of the whole thing of dating Prince. Rock stars are star fuckers. Nikki might just as easily have grabbed Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies. Frankly, Vanity was not very attractive around that time. She was out of it an awful lot, and she looked a real mess. Let's just say that when you are strung out, personal hygiene is one of the first things to go.
January 24th, 1987. Van Nuys, midnight. We had a day off in the studio, so Tommy came around. Heather's away, filming on location, so we chilled out and watched some MTV. I made myself wait 30 minutes before I told Tommy I had some dope. It's not cool to look too eager. Tommy asked me to shoot him up in the same place he always does. The rose tattoo in the crook of his arm, the spot where nobody can see. If Heather knew he was around here shooting smack with me, she would be gone. She'd be history. I love Tommy. He's the brother I never had. He loves me enough to come here and take a holiday in my hell. But then he goes, and I'm still here. Tommy, my partner in crime and fellow toxic twin, would visit me on Valley Vista Boulevard every now and then. Sometimes we'd shoot up heroin, but Tommy was smarter than me. He never got hooked. He always said that heroin scared him because it was just too good. But he had his little packages of syringes over at his and Heather Locklear's mansion, but it was only for cocaine.
Tommy Lee. As soon as I took smack with Nikki, I realized how easily I could get addicted. I knew if I fuck with it big time, it would either kill me or send me into a huge downward spiral of chasing some fucking fantasy. If I had taken it to a dark place, I just wouldn't have got out. I knew how much I loved it and how careful I had to be. I always did heroin with a little bit of fear. I guess you don't enjoy it as much if you're fearful of it. Whenever I visited Nikki, I would hang with him and get fucked up for a day or two, and then I'd tell myself, okay, let's get back to Heather. This is dark as fuck.
2:55 a.m. One could say I'm having a 10cc love affair. My mistress is so seductive. She sneaks, she lies. In fact, she will lie dormant if that's what's needed to seduce me from my lifetime commitment. My music. Some could say I'm married to my music. Others, fuck them. Is this a crisis or a needed creative outlet? There she goes again, whispering in my ear. Sometimes I think I hear her say that I'm gonna die. January 26, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:10 a.m. Bob Michaels just left. We hung out and got high, but he really pisses me off. Bob will do coke and drink all night, but gets all lame whenever I try to give him junk. I suppose I understand why, but it's not like he's clean living. Maybe I should just give him some China White to snort and tell him it's coke. Fuck, he's my friend. I know how much he'd enjoy it.
Bob Michaels. I used to do loads of pot and coke with Nikki, but I'd never do heroin. I was terrified of needles. Most junkies don't give a fuck what other people are doing as long as they can get their own drugs. But Nikki was different. He was always trying to get me to do a shot because it would be awesome. Once or twice, I left my pipe out on the counter, and when I wasn't looking, Nikki sprinkled heroin in it. I'd get a lot higher than I expected, and when I looked over at him, he'd be laughing at me.
10:20 p.m. I'm very impressed with myself, if I say so myself. I'm maintaining okay in the studio. It helps if I do a couple lines of coke before I go in, then maybe a snort of dope so that I don't feel too jumpy. The methadone, of course, then a few trips to the bathroom while we're rehearsing. It's hard, but I'm keeping an even keel until I get home in the evenings, and then all hell breaks loose. It's when I come home that it's really hard. My secret room keeps talking to me. I'm not listening. I'm really trying.
Tommy Lee. Nikki was coming to the studio nicely sedated. He can be quite the control freak, but when he was on heroin, he was absolutely out of control, so he couldn't be in control. I just found him very lax, which isn't his personality.
Six is Sagittarius, but he's got the personality of Taurus, a bull.
January 28, 1987, Van Nuys, 4 a.m. Tonight, diary, I'm going to try something different. Instead of writing to you after an evening of psychosis, I'm going to write to you while it's happening. Maybe someday somebody can read this and understand what hell is. So here I sit. The curtains are drawn. The candles are lit. And it's just me and you. My guitar's on my lap. My diary's on the table. And I'm ready. Let's see what happens. I just did it. My head is exploding. I feel like throwing up. Now I know. What I hear isn't there. There is someone. It's 4:40 a.m. I need to get on paper what just happened. I was convinced 30 minutes ago that there were people outside my house. There is nobody outside the house. What the fuck is wrong with me? I can't stop, but I want to still do it. I need this. I can't stop. I don't know how to stop thinking about it. I want to get high. I don't want to go insane. I know it's fake. I know it's fake. I know it's not real. It's just the drugs. Sometimes when I sit here alone, surrounded by only candles, the shadows dancing on the walls, feel like my only friends. I'm listening to Tommy Bowl and I'm trying to think of a reason to pick up my guitar. I wonder if this is how he felt right before he died. This isn't how I thought life would turn out. I can't seem to read anything lately. Music seems abrasive. The scabs on my arms are festering with infection. I can't seem to breathe from the blow, and I can't seem to get drunk anymore. I'm at the edge. I feel like I'm standing at death's door, and no one will let me in. Why can't I do drugs like everybody else? Everybody else does the drugs and they're okay. I do the drugs and things happen to me that I can't explain. I'm trying to put it on paper, but I can't. I can only describe it, and you must think I'm insane, but I'm not. I'm sitting here right now sane as the next guy. It's just the drugs. It's not me. I remember back in Idaho going fishing and hunting as a kid. I remember discovering Deep Purple on my cheap little AM/FM radio, my first crushes and those warm summer nights in the park. I want to go back to those times of innocence. I've forgotten who I was. Please, God, make it stop.
Bob Timmons. Cocaine gave Nicky acute paranoia and hallucinations. One night he called me and asked me to get the police over to his house right away, because there were little men with helmets and guns in the trees surrounding his house. It took me quite a while to talk him down from that one.
So good, so bad. Chinese highs, pearly white, down the main line. So sad Susie has the blues up in Soho. Says it's cold as ice deep down in her arm. White horse screams, unpleasant dreams and pain. Blind lead the blind like the German faith, riding high through the graveyard of the night. January 29, 1987, Van Nuys, 7:30 a.m. I've been up to no good again, diary, but it's given me a killer idea for a song. Becky came around again yesterday during her school lunch break. As she was getting dressed again afterwards, putting that Catholic school uniform back on, I asked her about the Lord's Prayer. Is it important? So she looked at me wide-eyed and said, sure, it's really important. So I got her to recite it for me. I scribbled down a few notes. Then I dropped her back at school on my Harley. The nuns all looked horrified when they saw me, like they were going to have a heart attack. They will, too, if they hear the song I'm writing. So Becky was a local schoolgirl who used to get very friendly with me on her lunch breaks. She had a very famous mom who would freak out if she knew what her daughter was doing back then. So you know what? I'm not going to tell you who she was. January 30th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. Today has turned tonight. I laid around all day, naked, playing guitar, writing, writing, writing. This lovely